and welcome to Progressive Opinions of Color, a podcast that seeks to create space for people of color and conversations about economics and politics. Now it's also become more of people of color who are progressive talking about everything. I'm your host, Nancy Wu, and today I have a special guest with me. Her name is Yami. She is an educator, an amazing writer. I met her at the Tin House Winter Workshop this past winter, and her writing has been amazing. I'm really excited for her to be here today. We're going to talk about The Happiest Season and queer representation in film. Also, we're going to talk a lot about writing, about educating, and what it's like to be a teacher and an educator during this time of COVID. And we'll just go off and talk about everything. I'm really excited for you guys to hear this episode. This is going to be the last episode of 2020, so I will see you guys in 2021 for the next episode. And as always, suggestions are welcome. Please, please, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if you're enjoying this podcast. It really helps me as a new podcaster, and especially there are some trolls out there leaving some 1-star reviews from, like, I don't know, Republican, like, racist stuff. You can check it out on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, make sure to leave a 5-star review for this podcast because it really helps me out as a new podcaster, especially if you're enjoying this. Please share it with your friends and subscribe on all our social media. And I hope you guys are staying safe and healthy. Thank you so much for supporting and listening to this podcast since it's been alive in August. It has only been barely 4 months, and I'm so excited to share these things with you guys. So let's get started. Hi, today I have Yami here with me. How are you?
I'm good. It's been too long. I was reminiscing about Tin House the other day. And by reminiscing, I mean like looking at old pictures, sending them to Annie and crying. So
I want to see them too. So yeah, Yami and I met at the Tin House Winter Workshop with Esme Weijin Wong, who is a badass. And we were in a writing workshop together right before the pandemic hit, which was such good timing because holy shit, I cannot imagine like not having had the opportunity to see y'all in person because that was so much fun.
It was incredible. It was, I still like those sea lions, they have a very special place in my heart.
Oh yeah, they're so cute. So why don't you tell everyone what you do, who you are, and like.
So I am an educator by trade. I guess also a little bit in identity wise, I do really like to teach. But I've worked in education in like lots of different capacities. That's why I like to say it very vaguely. But like right now, I'm tutoring. I do have a classroom teaching background and some like administrative work too. And I am also a writer. I write mostly essays, but I also enjoy to write fiction. I am not a poet, much to my own dismay, but
can't do everything. Save some like talent for the rest of us.
Well, listen, I appreciate it. Thank you. That's very kind. I actually just am excited because I randomly and like in a very surprised manner got nominated for Best Small Fictions the other day.
Yes. Congratulations. Holy shit.
Yeah, I didn't see it coming at all. I only published one thing in the whole calendar year of 2020 because, I mean, I'm sure you can imagine why, but it was so exciting. So I will see what happens with that, but I'm just excited to be nominated because that is very nice. Thank you, Barrel House.
That's super exciting. Congratulations. I will include the link for everyone if you guys want to read it. It will be below in the show notes. So how has life as an educator been since COVID? What's the age group that you teach? How has the Zoom life transition been? I want to hear all about it.
It's been pure chaos. Because I taught in schools before I was a tutor, a lot of my friends are still like classroom teachers. And so it feels terrible to be like, I'm having a really hard time when it's like, I listen to them talk and like, actually they're having a really hard time. But after a couple months of hearing teachers saying, you know, I am now working 16-hour days. I am now, yep, like basically round the clock, like every waking hour, I'm figuring something out. Like, even as they were explaining it to me, I'm just like, how is that possible? Like, why why? Like, you don't have recess duty anymore. Like, you don't have to like call parents and hold kids for detention anymore. Like, you don't have to like, what, where's all the work coming from? And then I, you know, took a moment to reflect on my own life and how like I hadn't written a word since Gin House, like not an singular sentence. And I was like, wait, how is that happening? Like, where's the time going? And I realized like, I'm used to in my spare time staring at a screen, you know, like I get home from work and there's a screen. I'm either on my phone or on my computer or what have you. I didn't realize, and I wasn't mentally clocking all of the extra hours that it was taking to transfer all of my systems and all of the ways that like of organization and communication and whatever that made my world go round as an educator. Every single one of those things had to change. Like, the way I send emails, the way I send, like I had to make homework trackers for my kids because everything's virtual. When it's pieces of paper that I'm bringing to your house and I'm like, hi, this is the homework, have it completed next time, right? Like for most of my students, like that piece of paper just lived on the dining room table. And they would just do it at the dining room table and then leave it on the dining room table. And then when I showed up next week, it's on the dining room table and we went over it together. That does not work with virtual. I am better at it now, but like there were so many like extra intense unpaid hours. There were so many bizarre emails that had to be written and sent. There were so many phone calls to just sort of like restructure everything. And that's me as a tutor, right? So classroom teachers, every single thing that they do had to be changed and like modified and like optimized for like the digital Zoom world. So everyone's tired. If you know an educator, know that they are tired.
Yeah, that's insane. That's like freaking finance hours, even more.
Yeah, no, it is. And listen, teaching has always been too much work. Let me be very clear. Something that gets like coded as like women's work always means that it's underpaid.
teachers are so underpaid.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I remember one of the reasons I left the classroom was the like really intense like pushback I got from like needing to take time off for being sick, because I'm also chronically ill. So it was this constant thing where like people, like when I would be hired at a new school, you know, a principal would be like, I'd be like, yeah, please understand, like I am chronically ill, like I'm going to need time off, I'm going to need blah blah blah. And they would be like, of course, we totally understand, we're a family here, blah blah blah. And then invariably, you know what I mean, like I need time off, and it doesn't matter that tomorrow's a final. Like my body doesn't care. Love to schedule my illness at times that's more convenient, not only for you, but for everyone. That'd be cool, right? I would just schedule it right out of my life. But like, that's not how that works. And so the way that those conversations were so frequent, so tense, and sort of its own job, it was like a separate job to sort of manage people's reactions and responses and what have you, to just like me needing a fucking break. I once like cried in a school building because I could not get a bathroom break, which for like the nature of my condition is extremely bad. Like I need to be able to go to the bathroom whenever, but they had me teaching 120 kids by myself. And it was science. So there was literal dirt and literal fire in my room. So I was like, I can't just go to the bathroom. There needs to be someone else here so I can go. And the way that like that was an enormous problem. It was just an enormous inconvenience to get me a bathroom break during the day, where to the point where like I was like reduced to tears. It's brutal. And that's not even that bad. Like of all the things that happen in education, like that's barely the tip of the iceberg. So it is an intense job all around. So then having people sort of redo the things that they were already good at and the systems they already got down, having them have to redo all of that for this virtual thing, and then not being compensated in any way, shape, or form. Just people's just sort of not caring. I don't know. I also had like an office job and that didn't change. I just did the same thing I did in the office at my computer. It was fine.
You're working two jobs during COVID, an office job and school?
Yes, I was doing that before. That other job is sort of like phasing out because, you know, like everywhere else, you know, you work in nonprofits, you don't have as much money now as you did before, and you already didn't have a lot of money. So a lot of like cutting hours and that type of thing has affected me. Luckily, so far, I'm still okay, like with the tutoring and with just like trying to be intelligent about my spending, which like, LOL, I'm also a Sagittarius. So stay tuned to find out how that fits. Yeah, no. So I was doing both of those things, and it was convenient because I was just like on the Upper East Side all the time. Like I was tutoring my kiddos, and then I was in like popping into the office for a couple of hours, and it was just not challenging at all to manage both of them. Just exhausting, obviously. But I want to acknowledge the fact that like as a tutor, I'm sort of like not serving the community I want to be serving.
What do you mean?
Because like my clients are exactly who you think they are.
Like rich people who can pay to get ahead in life.
Exactly. And I feel a little weird not having acknowledged that. And I'm glad I just realized it. I just don't know if there's a way to make it so that that doesn't come up. But it feels weird to talk about things like racial justice and whatever, and like not talk about sort of my own complicity in that too. You know, I'm like really like tutoring white kids so they get ahead.
It's a complicated thing because I feel like this podcast is about progressive politics, but at the end of the day, me and everyone I interview are complicit in capitalism because this is our society. And until it changes, we're going to need money to get by, to pay rent and to do shit, unfortunately. And the things that you make money from are not necessarily like equitable organizations. Like in fact, probably most for-profit corporations or jobs exacerbate income and educational inequality.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I mentioned that I'm a tutor. And I was previously a classroom teacher, and like the demographics of people that I'm like, at the end of the day, like I like to teach because I really, really enjoy that moment when something clicks. And like, it's not specifically with kids, you know, but like teaching kids is like a sort of easier job to get than like teaching adults. So I teach kids, and kids are great. So I will work with them, but it's there's like also realities, and their financial realities and their societal realities. They are it's uncomfortable. Like my work in the classroom was more closely aligned with my beliefs. It just was. Like the communities I was serving, like kids who look like me, kids who grew up the way that I grew up. Like those are the people I want to help. And like, that is the role that I want to play. Right. But then the reality was, couldn't even get a bathroom break. Those are no longer the students that I help. As a tutor, you charge, I mean, in New York, you charge over $100 an hour. If you want people to take you. Yeah. And it's like, my thing is the flexibility is paramount to my life. Like as someone who lives in this body, right? I can't be trapped in a building all day and then have my entire Sunday also be a work day and have to fight people to use the bathroom, have to fight people to take time off, be in meetings with the principal because I had the audacity to call someone out for not letting me do those things to take care of myself, right? Like I needed the flexibility. And so I am now like the students that I tutor. I mean, they're exactly who you think they are. They're people who can afford to pay over $100. Honestly, most of my students pay more than that, right? An hour to get help on, you guessed it, standardized testing. So all of those scores that you're seeing, right, all of that inflation, like it's happening with this behind the scenes work, and it doesn't feel good. I'm not going to lie. It does not feel good to be complicit in that. It does not feel good to be part of, you know, setting that unrealistically high barrier. Like I am the reason a good number of people are going to get a 36 on their ACT. And the students I'm working with now are in no way, shape, or form more intelligent than the students I was working with before. Not at all. Like all of my kids are bright. all of my kids are so, so, so bright. All the kids I've ever worked with astound me and like can run circles around me. They are all so intelligent. And it just is unfortunate that like what I do is I teach kids the language of the test. I teach them this particular test's particular tricks because I spend all of my time just taking these tests and looking at them and thinking about them. And why would you say this like that? Like, why would you disguise the trig in this problem? And what words did you use to disguise it? Now I can just like demystify that for my students and say, hi, this is just a trig problem. It's just in disguise. And like, here are the words that they use in here. And that's what I do now. And that's information that would benefit everybody, right? Like that is some, it's not, you're not smarter because when someone told you how something works, you were able to make it work for you. Like you just are someone with that information. To combat this, I do pro bono work as well. So that is something. It's a bit more challenging now with COVID, but I just be through like relationships with schools and stuff, I can like help out families who can't pay, right? The schools can pay. Like there are lots of like, there's flexibility in that agreement. But again, where does that flexibility come from? It comes from the fact that these other folks can pay so much to get help. And like people can come in with perfectly normal scores and leave with stellar scores. People can come in being incredibly intelligent, but just not testing well at all and leave with a perfectly good score. Like it's one of those things you sit with. It's like at the end of the day, like my complicity is something that I'm not going to pretend doesn't exist. Who does that help? Right. I'm going to be someone who does what they can. And as soon as I cannot do this anymore, you know, cause the ethics are so cringe, you know, the ethics are so misaligned with who I am and what I want from the world. So like eventually I'm not gonna be able to do this anymore. But as long as it's the only thing, especially now with COVID taking away other forms of income, like as long as it's the only thing keeping my rep paid, like I just have to do it.
Yeah, it's like these standardized tests are supposed to be so meritocratic and they're not, because people can pay to get even better scores. I think that's something I realized like when I went to college, and I really thought that everyone in high school was just struggling to get good grades and going through the same shit. But no, a lot of people had classes and extra resources to help them like get even higher scores and therefore better chances. And also really rich parents who like donated buildings and shit. So
yeah. All of that is a thing, and it is an uncomfortable thing, much like everything else. But I just, you know, at the end of the day, like right now being true to myself means acknowledging that and being like, I am not going to lie to anybody who asks me about it. I'm not going to like skirt around that because it makes me uncomfortable. Nah, fuck my discomfort. Do you know what I mean? Like my discomfort is not as important as like other people's futures. So
do you think COVID is going to change education permanently? Like, do you think kids are getting everything that they need?
I wish I had something like positive to say about that. I think unfortunately it's all changing for the worse. You have to wonder what gets, when anything like unprecedented happens, you have to wonder what gets revealed that like wasn't maybe as clear before. And unfortunately for COVID, one of the things that got revealed is like exactly how much more can you exploit folks than you already were. And, you know, whether that means like you can get someone to literally risk their lives to come in and bag groceries for you for minimum wage, right? That's probably something that a couple years ago, had you asked somebody, do you think your employees would like risk literal death to come do this minimum wage job? They probably would have been like, no, my employees wouldn't do that. Please. My employees are too lazy, or whatever it is that people think about workers. I think that's now been proven true, right? Is that you can see people will literally risk their actual life and health and, you know, all of the like extended complications about COVID that we don't even know yet because it's such a new thing. Like people are risking all of that to go get minimum wage right now, and they won't raise it to $15, and people are still doing that. Do you see what I mean? Like the way that's sort of exposing the fact that we are they can go even further than they're already going in terms of exploiting the working class. And then, and that goes for teachers as well, who, you know, obviously aren't bagging groceries or I mean, hopefully aren't bagging groceries. I know a lot of teachers with side hustles. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was a thing. Yeah. The way we're seeing that, like, teachers are going in every time the state's like, we're reopening the schools, go in. And they do, they go in and they risk it all, literally. So I think, unfortunately, that can't be unseen. And I think it's going to be remembered when future policy is made. I don't think people are going to be as afraid to lose their employees, especially since those are the people who haven't lost their jobs. Do you know what I mean? Like we're not even talking about the, God, how many millions are unemployed now? Like 12.6 million people. Like I'm not even talking about those 12.6 million because that's not my experience. And so I can't speak to that apart from being obviously horrified and concerned about that. But like the way that if people weren't worried about just firing and replacing people before, they most certainly have no reason to be now. Because those, you know, 12.6 million people would do many things for a job right now, I'm sure.
That's why those small business loans that the government was giving back in the beginning of the pandemic were so important, because it's like you get this huge loan depending on how many people you have under the condition that you don't fire your workers after COVID and throughout. But I guess that doesn't really apply to nonprofits or schools.
I don't know. I mean, I'm always going to hope for the best. I want good things to come out of this. I don't want it to be that terrible. And it feels a little cynical to say it, but it also is like we've seen the extent of the cruelty now in new ways. We've seen the ways that like people have been literally applauded. Like if you want to think of the like 7 p.m. clapping in New York City thing. Literally applauded for putting themselves in danger and then still like not get the basic PPE that they need. Like I don't know. I've never had like a really overwhelmingly bright and positive view of America, but like even for me, this was a little, whatever the negative connotation of the word enlightened, like whatever that word is. Combine the word enlightened with like this like holy fuck feeling that like you get when you're looking at something terrible.
Traumatized.
Yeah, right? Like, yeah, no, that I hope good things will come out of it. But I don't think so. I think they're gonna find new ways to exploit folks because of this. And I think they're gonna take it further.
Everyone needs to hear the real talk version of this because it's too common on Twitter. I mean, maybe not on Twitter, but on like just general news to feel optimistic when people are talking about how the economy is slightly going upwards. We're seeing more things open. I mean, not anymore, but like for a while. And that upwards direction got people excited. But like that upward direction of unemployment still means that 12.7 million people are unemployed, even if the rate of unemployment is lower than it was during the recession. It's still a shit ton of people. And let's not forget about that. I think optimism in a way can get in the way of actual policy changes that need to happen in order to actually like address issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Optimism can also be, especially when you're talking about something like the stock market, optimism can be really callous. Like it's really, and that's how it all started out, right? It started out with people being like, only 1% of people die. Excuse me? Like, I'm so sorry. Like, I'm not saying I wish like 80% of people die. Like, obviously not. But like, when you say that, when people were saying things like, oh, only people who are already sick are going to die. I was like, what? Like, you can't. I was so taken aback by how the ableism just like jumped out. It just jumped out and everybody was like, please. It's fine. I don't know if you saw the tweet. It was very early. It's a tweet from like March. Someone who said like, oh, I was wearing a mask because this was before, if you can remember back this far, before we were cautioned to wear masks.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yep. Before people, they were like, don't wear a mask because they were like, if you buy all the masks, we won't have enough for the staff who comes in contact with COVID every single day. But we're not going to tell you that. Like, we're also going to veto like mailing you masks so that you will have them and we can all start off from a safer place. what we're going to do instead is just lie to you. It's fine.
Ruin America, because that's the reason when you started off with a message like that, no wonder we have so many anti-maskers.
I can't even be mad about it. Like, I want to be, but I can't even be mad. But it's because it's like, we've all been there. We've all been there. We have all seen something that we believe to be true and been wrong. Like, we, like, every human being has had that experience. And so I'm like, how do you not understand when people are getting their information from the sources that they're getting it from, you know, wherever that may be? Like, how do you not understand how that's confusing? It's confusing. Even like, people are like, science is real. Science is real. Like, so numbers is what I do. I tutor in STEM. So science and math, like mostly math, but like, I like science better, but like, people only ever want math tutoring. Have you noticed that? They'll say things like 1%, knowing full well that people are thinking, well, if I got a like 99 on a test, like, I'd be a baller. Like, that's a good grade. You know, like, I'm fine with that, right? And then they'll also, on the flip side, say things like 12.9 million, right? And it's like, those, the way that statistics works, the way that percentages work, the way that averages work, like, those two numbers can be the same thing. There is a universe in which 1% is 12.9 million whatevers, right? And like, that's like, so much is getting lost in that gap of knowledge. Like, that, not knowledge, because people know that, right? But like, the sort of inability to conceptualize the difference between seeing a number, seeing a figure, right? And seeing a percentage. My complaint, a lot of people are saying like, more people voted for Biden than ever before. I'm like, I'm going to need to see some stats on that, because like, there are more people right now than ever before. So like, duh, like, more people voted in this election than any other election. I'm like, I'm going to need you to do just some basic level statistical analysis on that before you just throw a number out to get the desired impact. And so people can do that, right? They can actually make numbers lie, because people's perceptions of numbers are so odd. That is an enormous frustration, has been an enormous frustration for me, like, especially during this pandemic, because I'm like, y'all don't understand what you're saying. Like, you have no way to conceptualize how many people there are in the United States of America to say only 1% will die and not understand what a catastrophically enormous number of people that is.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I agree with that so much, because like, we're both numbers people. We see like the way that numbers can be spun toward whatever public relations goal that some media company has and be manipulated to tell people stories. That's what I do in my job all day. Like, I produce numbers about New York City real estate, and we publish the ones that are the most notable. There's this bias in publications of math and statistics and economics where the things that get published generally show interesting or new results. The research projects that find nothing don't get published. Most of the research actually finds nothing. I remember for my master's thesis, I was working so hard to like find a positive result to make it interesting. And it took so many different like modifications to the data set in order to make it an interesting result. And I think like, there's a danger in giving a lot of weight to numbers, because numbers can lie. Numbers can be biased. You see that one number, 1%, but you don't know how many other numbers there were in the research process. I feel like people assume that numbers give objectivity. And a lot of people always say like, show me the stats, show me the numbers. I want facts. I want math. I don't just want stories. But I feel like anecdotes are really powerful, because they show someone's actual lived experience. Like, that is a life. Someone else has gone through some shit. They have an anecdote that's shared. And I think we need both. I think we need both. And I think we need to share the numbers responsibly.
Absolutely. And I think not only are we going to need both, right? But like, what's missing to me is like, I'm feeling a bit like gaslit by the like fake news thing that everyone got on board with so quickly, because it's to use Obama's phrasing, what did he say? A snappy, what did he use the word snappy? God, he's old.
Oh, he did say snappy.
He said a snappy phrase or a snappy slogan or whatever it was.
Something snappy. It sounds snappy. Was this one like his talk about defund the police?
Yeah. Or he was like,
yeah, that's a snappy phrase that young people use, but like, you're going to lose listeners that way.
Yeah. LOL.
Let's talk about that.
I feel like and this is what I love about like millennials and Gen Z, is we have mastered the like, remember when, okay, this is, I'm jumping off to way too many tracks right now, but are you privy to the like Ocean Vuong thing that happened.
What happened with Ocean Vuong? I know he puts out a story about metaphors.
Yeah, people, and by people I mean like the white establishment of literature, were just like mad that he had the audacity to have a take.
Okay, because he said that phenomenology didn't originate from Husserl, but actually from Buddhism. And like,
they're like, how dare you say, people are like, I'm personally offended.
That's so dumb. I read all of his like his stories about metaphors. Like he wrote that entire essay and he also did like a Q&A with really great responses. And it's like, yeah, Western philosophy, the thoughts that come out of Western philosophy isn't really new. I think philosophers agree by now that there's no new thought, and like anything that the West has produced that they attribute to these figureheads of gravitas actually have thought of things like Eastern philosophers have thought of those things like years ago. Like,
absolutely.
My Asian brothers and sisters 5,000 years ago have thought these things. I'm sorry the Greeks didn't, but like, I'm sorry that Eastern philosophy thought of something that you guys like also repeated or also thought of. Why are people mad? I'm sorry, I just like went off on a tangent.
People were just like upset that they started to like correct him. It's exactly what you're saying, right? It's this idea of like, they're like, well, no, this is what my knowledge about these things are. They're like, at one point there was a question of like metaphor versus simile. And I'm like, bro, I literally don't care. You know what? I literally do you know what's helpful? A 30-page Instagram story where I got a real breakdown, and I love it. I love when so maybe this is a numbers people thing. Maybe you can like agree with me, but I love when a mechanism is given to me, even knowing that like mechanisms are you know, there's always a flaw, right? There's always something that doesn't fit. There's always like a mechanism is like a lens, right? If you want to look at it from a more humanities point of view, but I just like show me how it works. You know what I mean? Like literally take it apart, like give me the name of the machine, give me the name of all of its little gears, like show me how it works. And I love that. I love to be able to put something sort of like overlay it onto a new flow chart, so to speak. So like I loved that. I loved his framework for it. I thought it was fresh, but I don't have an MFA. It's applying, so we'll see what happens. But I don't have an MFA, so like I don't have a whole lot of that experience of like sitting in a room and having people literally talk to me about, today we're going to have a lecture on, we're going to do readings on, you know, metaphor, the concept. So maybe it was just fresh to me because that's just like a gap in my own knowledge. But I thought it was beautifully phrased. I thought it was so accessible. The fact that it was like essentially like a mini course and it was free 99. Like I love this. I love this thing that a lot of my favorite writers do, which is every now and again, they'll just do something for free to be like, we understand that access is a problem. So like here is, or like Esme herself does, scholarships to all of her seminars, workshops, things like that she leads. Like, and I'm so grateful for things like that. I have had the pleasure of learning from her already. So I want to leave those spots for other people for now. But eventually, like, I'm going to jump in there and be like, thank God, I don't have to like, you know, find $600 or whatever to like learn about metaphor today. I don't know. Someone on my timeline was like, I can't afford to go to UMass. But I'm like, okay. But you could afford to go onto IG and watch the story. And that's like, I'm not saying it's enough, right? But the fact that people care enough to do what they can, like that to me goes a very long way. And that's what I look for when I'm thinking about who I want in my community. I'm looking for people who do what they can when they can. So like, I thought it was like a beautifully kind thing to do. And the way that people reacted, I just can't. I'm like, it was helpful to me as someone who's been stuck and like trying to write and having a really hard time, thinking about like my own metaphors and why I don't like them anymore. But like, it was helpful to me. And you know what wasn't helpful to me? All of these like know-it-alls jumping in the comments, something to say, just to be like, no, actually, like I don't care. I don't care that is what you had to add. Like, what a bummer that's all you had to say about this. Imagine contributing so little. I was really annoyed by that.
It was free knowledge. It was so well written. I cannot believe how intelligent he is.
And the way that the very first thing he said was like, listen, this is my viewpoint on this, right? This is a mechanism. Like, take it if it's useful, right? Overlay it on your life and see if something new comes out, some new connections come out of it. Like, is that so bonkers? Like, like nothing works for everything or everyone. But it's interesting which of those things that don't work for everyone, we decide have merit and value, and which ones we do not. Like, wonder what it could be. It's racism. It's always racism. It is racism. It is xenophobia. It is homophobia. It is all, is transphobia. It is all of those things every time. Did you see Happiest Season? Did you watch it?
No.
Okay. I'm so full of feelings about it.
Oh my God.
I'm full of them. It's fine.
Wait, let me look this up.
It was like,
oh.
Yeah. it's Kristen Stewart and homegirl whose name I should know because she was already a very big deal. And then, I mean, apparently, listen, I don't watch TV. So that makes it, that's my angle that I'm coming at it from. So I'm like, I don't watch TV, but I did watch that. And I did watch, I almost said like, Portrait of a Painted Lady. No, Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
I don't watch shows with like only white people.
And that is a stance that I'm going to have to firmly adopt from here on out because that is essentially my issue. Like that is my whole problem with it. Do y'all not see what you look like and what you said, especially like when you're posting these things on Twitter? Like you just posted 4 screenshots. Also like, so Sarah Paulson, I love and adore. So I also watched Ratched, which is being sort of grouped with all of these movies. And then there's one more that I didn't see, but it's all like the same plot. And like, it's just like two classically beautiful, like skinny white women get together. You're just like, bro, I don't care. Like, why do we keep doing this? They're like, oh, but one's a brunette. And I'm like, no, why? Why?
Oh my God, so diverse.
Like, why do I care? And why, like, I don't know. So I have a lot of feelings that are like basically that around all those movies. And like the way that people look when they like post them on Twitter and they're like, what a year for representation. I'm like, you are the worst.
Like, do they think that like two white women getting together is like representation for like queer
because
folks?
because there's a queer holiday movie.
Yeah, that's not like,
thank you. I was like, they're like, oh my God, it's a queer Christmas movie, like I'm all about it. And I'm just like, I cannot stand it. Like magpies, you take one little shiny thing and everyone just forgets all of the things that are supposedly were so important this year, right? Because like they were so important this year. Like this was the year that we like all decided to be woke, right? Isn't that what 2020 was? No, that was a seasonal thing. Okay, cool. I've definitely noticed. They bought their little anti-racist books and then patted themselves on the back and then just went on their merry way. Like literally July. I remember it because, you know, I'm mostly on Twitter for books. So all of the like best of lists, people like hyping other people's books and what have you. And in June, it was a lot of white folks being like, here's the like one black person I know with a book coming out, like buy their book, right? And literally in the July releases did not have that happen for them.
Oh.
Like in literally 30 days, it went from now we're going to hype everybody on, we're going to hype all the black people we know, two people on our timeline every single day. And so then, you know, and I'm happy for those authors who got those pre-orders, who got those sales, who got that, you know what I mean? Like good. That's part of what we should be doing is talking with our money. But like the fact that even like July releases didn't get the attention that June releases got. And the fact that like the books we're still talking about in December, even though it's been literally 6 months since June, are books that were released in June and books that were released like right before all of this stuff happened. Like the fact that that's what we're still talking about, it is like enormously performative, enormously. And I just like, I'm like, y'all don't know what you look like in June, retweeting all two black people that you know, and then in December being like, what a year for representation, with 4 pictures of the same couple in different garb talking about, oh my God, representation. Like I was like, you don't know what you look like. You look like a damn fool. That is what you look like.
Oh my God, that's so fucking annoying.
The words escape me if I think about it for too long. But yeah, that is a lot of my feelings about the movie are tied into all that. I also, though, like, watched it and Uncut Gems in the same week.
What's Uncut Gems? What are these TV shows? Let me look at them.
Well, Uncut Gems is a movie. It's Adam Sandler.
These are all... See, I don't watch, like... Oh, I guess there is a one black guy in here. When, like, the headline is, like, a white dude or, like, white people, I just skip... I just scroll past it when I'm on Netflix or something.
As you should. It would have saved me the heartache. Had I been so discerning, I would be in, like, a far better situation right now. But no, I watched both those movies because they were... What happened was I had watched everything that I, like, wanted to see. And I was like, I just need something on to, like, distract me from my own anxiety. Which, by the way, I didn't read anything about Uncut Gems going in. So I didn't know that that was the literal worst possible film I could have chosen, like, in the entire universe. Uncut Gems, pure unadulterated anxiety from beginning to end. There is not a second where they let up. I wish I had something, like, really new to add, but it's like you said, right? There aren't new thoughts, right? The only thing I have to offer, two things, I guess. One is, I would say both of those movies have one thing in common, which is this, like, very relentless quality. Like, I said earlier, but, like, Uncut Gems is literally from start to finish just pure anxiety. It is, like, no filter anxiety. Just, like, pure, like, people shout over each other the entire movie. No thoughts get finished. There's, like, zero, like, I don't know if you care about spoilers, but to put it, like, vaguely, there is just, like, there's just no care for like the emotions of someone who's not used to seeing this, who's not used to being in this man's world. Like, they rendered it incredibly well for me, where I was just like, I got the same feeling that I get when I walk into a new place, where I'm like, there is a flow here, right? There are norms, there is a culture, there is whatever, and I don't know what it is. So it's time for me to, like, take a minute, take a beat, and see what I can listen to and see what I can pick up on, to make sure that, you know, at the very least, I'm not going to be, like, openly disrespectful in this new space, right? It's that same feeling of when something's rendered so well that you arrive there and you're like, aha, I have arrived at a place. And I need to pay attention because it is a place that I have not been in before. So they did an incredible job with that. But, like, the whole thing, it's like you never, like, your heartbeat just never goes back to normal. It never goes back to normal for the
moment. Terrible.
Yeah, literally until they murder him. At the very end. The whole movie, it's just like anxiety, 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 murder. And then it's over. So, like, different movies. And it's like, I'm not much of an action film person, so I was just unprepared on all counts. However, that, like, relentless thing of, like, we don't care that you need a break feeling, I would say there's an aspect of that as well in Happiest Season, in that, like, people were like, this is not funny, it's triggering. That's what a lot of the discourse online is like. They're like, no, I'm, like, feeling triggered. I'm, like, remembering the time I was brought home into a space where I was suddenly shoved into a closet and everything was terrible and everything was a microaggression and everything was mean. And it just, like, spiraled and spiraled and spiraled until, like, terrible things happen. And so people are saying, like, this is not a film for queer people because queer people, like, don't need the stress in their lives. Like, they just don't need this.
For, like, straight people to watch and, like, kind of, like, live vicariously through and, like...
Yeah, and that's what a lot of...
If a film is about queer people, it should be made in a way where queer people want to watch it and not feel, like, so triggered by it.
And there are queer people who loved it, right? Like, I mean, my take is I'm somewhere in the middle of all of this, right? But, like, it's made by... Did you ever see But I'm a Cheerleader?
No.
Okay, well, it's the same director, so she's, like, a very big deal. It has Okay, great. So it is Natasha Lyonne. The director of Happiest Season was in But I'm a Cheerleader, which is just, like, this iconic lesbian classic movie that you, like, everyone has to see. And it's from, like, 1999. So it's one...
You're, like, about how, like, I'm gay, but I'm a cheerleader.
Yep. What I like about it is that it's really, like, well-done satire. It is, you know... for white people, and as is Happy Season. And one of the things that some of the things that I like read, like Autostraddle did a little roundtable about it and published it. And they were basically just saying like, oh, it was really white, but you know, we knew that. So like, and then like proceeded to like say other things, about it. And I was just like, yeah, they were like, they were very like unabashedly white about it, but like it went so far as to like include the almost like mandatory, like quota, like two peripheral people of color characters, which were, twins that were mixed race. Okay. So the person who is black in the film is, has married into this very white family and has produced two creepy children. Like they're creepy. That's the whole, their whole personality for the entire thing. Right. Because side characters and, especially side characters of color, white people movies, right? Zero personality. And they have them like literally commit a crime. And that's the only thing they do in the whole movie is like commit a crime and then disappear for an extended period of time, which like, what a metaphor for how the white queer community sees the rest of us.
It made the people of color, and the only people of color in the film be the criminals.
Literally steal. And then not only steal, but wait, just wait for this. This is literally like every like racist Republican's wet dream. Like steal from a store and then frame a white person for it.
And that was their diversity quota. That's like that's straight up like racism. That's not even a microaggression.
It's like literally every single, all the things, right? All the boxes have been ticked. And they do mention this in the like coverage a little bit. People are like, yeah, they didn't do a really good job with like the kids. I thought that wasn't very well done. And I'm like, oh, word? You didn't think, okay. But yeah, so it was not the sort of scathing takedown of that moment that I wanted, but at least it was acknowledged, which like, I feel like we've gotten to a point in the discourse where we now like point to the thing. We're like, oh yes, racism. And then we just move on. Like we've yet to get to a point where we say racism and then we say, okay, now let's do something about it. But at least now people are calling it what it is and like saying that. And like that makes it to sort of the mainstream. You know, kinda. my version of the mainstream, which is my like very queer and black thread. My very queer and black like timelines.
I mean, Black Lives Matter was a big thing years ago, and I don't think anyone really jumped on the bandwagon until this year out of like social media pressure, out of performative shit. And we talked a bit about how that didn't last past June. How is it now? Why do people suddenly care?
There are a lot of people out here like thinking and talking about this. And one of the like larger narratives is like, well, social media is like very much taken over in a way that I would argue like in 2015 it hadn't. And to be fair, I'm coming from the point of view of someone who I don't like know what TikTok is really, but like the really viral ones that end up on Twitter, I watch them and I enjoy them and I think they're wonderful. And like, go Gen Z for being so much better at everything than I am.
I think Gen Z is amazing. They're really the best generation. They're like so woke, so stylish, so funny, so impressed and like open about it.
They will read you for filth, and I love it. I am well aware of the fact that Gen Z doesn't love me back, and it's okay. It's okay. They don't have to. They can do their own. The fact that, you know, in 2015, I was like maybe on Facebook a little bit, and now in 2020, I have a Twitter and an Instagram, and I check them both every day. I'm not alone in that. Do you know what I mean? Like I think a lot of people who were slow to social media, who maybe didn't like it at first or whatever, maybe had to learn to do it for a job or whatever. And now they're like, well, now that I know how it works, you know, now I'm here. Yeah. So I think there's something to the social media question of that, where it's like virality was a thing in 2015, but it doesn't hold a candle to 2020 virality. Like it just doesn't, right? More people, more mess. So like it's, yeah. The chaos sort of like shatters the ceiling every time it happens again. So I think that that's definitely part of it. Even seeing, you know, Trayvon Martin stuff then, like, was not quite like seeing George Floyd stuff. there are a lot of people, by the way, this is like a discussion in the Black community where like many folks feel like, why are y'all acting different about this now? Like, this has always been a thing, and I just don't understand what it is. Like, even within the community, people are like asking each other, like, why, what made them care? You know, there's a social media thing. I also personally think that the pandemic was in large part, what was I doing in 2015 versus what was I doing in 2020 is another question to ask. And then not just me, but like on like a larger scale, what were we all doing then that we now, that can't distract us now? You know what I mean? Like, I can't, we were literally all just stuck at home scrolling and seeing that footage over and over and over again, and like traumatizing ourselves over and over and over again. And it's like, it hits different when you're at your own personal rock bottom, which I think a lot of us were. People's emotions are changeable and like very, very affected by circumstance. And the circumstances are just incomparable, even when you're looking at the same thing, right? It's not going to feel the same.
Even now, like when I find an influencer I really like, I like scroll through their Instagram, and if they don't have a black square, I'm kind of like, do you not care? Do you not know what's going on with the world?
Right.
But at the same time, the black square doesn't mean much because it's a performative signal.
Yep.
And you got to judge people by it. Like, I don't know how I feel about that.
Right. There's the thing about performativity is that it's sort of two things at the same time. It is nothing, which is why people are mad about it. But it is also, because it's nothing, it's the bare minimum that you can do. So it sends sort of two messages simultaneously. And you're like, depending on where you're at emotionally and how, what you're ready to receive in a moment, like you could take it any of those ways. It was wild to see who did the thing, you know, and like who didn't.
Who did it are at least like willing to learn. Like, they're willing to make the first step. They don't want to come off as racist. Their intentions of posting it is to show that they have the intention of not being racist. Of course, a lot of them are a ways away from that, but it's the first step. It means they're not one of those Blue Lives Matter people, which in my hometown, there's lots of flags about that.
And everyone's, right? And everyone's on that is a lot of them.
I'm like, at least you're willing to listen, hopefully.
The messaging has changed. I don't know if did you see The Social Dilemma? I feel like I sound like I watch so much TV, but I really don't.
I haven't seen any of these like TV shows.
So it's just a documentary that was meant to be like, this is what social media is doing to our lives. But as I'm sure you can see looking at it was just a whole bunch of like white bros who like are in some way, shape or form responsible for some of the like tech bullshit that goes into social media, being like, I just started to become like concerned. I just thought that like things were going in a direction that I just like didn't want. And I'm like, these are the people whose perspective, like on the one hand, I'm like, okay, if you were there and you saw it come up, you know, like that's interesting to me for a moment, right? Like, I want a brief history of tech from you, since you were the only one they let in to like make tech into a thing, right? So we're going to need to like bring in the like white bro opinion for that. But like, after that, like, I don't trust your analysis, bro. Like, I need somebody else to, and I need someone who is trained in intersectionality from birth, such as myself or you or anybody that I talk to IRL. Like, I'm surrounded by all these like really brilliant people who, because they're people of color, because they're queer people, because they're not cis people, right, are like sitting at intersections. And the way that just like flexes muscles in your brain, that like when other people don't have to, they just don't, right? Like, the way that is like a capability that just comes, like it is an amazing, incredible skill that's just built into literally every single person that I have the pleasure of talking to regularly. Like, the way you're going to put someone in front of me who lacks that, to me, like, you haven't met the bar to be on TV talking about this. Like, I'm so sorry, but you're just not smart enough for me. No, I'm like, because obviously there are like lots of different kinds of intelligence, right? And I'm not saying that there's nothing to be gained from that perspective, but like do you know how to analyze? Do you really, like, have you really had to think like that? I've had to think like that to survive. I'm surrounded by people who've had to think at that level of critical thinking that is like astronomically high. We've had to function at that level to live, just to walk into the fucking train and make it out okay. Just to walk into a fucking meeting and make it out and still have your job, right? Like, so I'm just like, you lack that skill. And I kind of just like, don't even care what you think. I mean, I'm going to need some credentials at that point. Do you know what I mean? Like, I want it on paper that you have done the hours that some of us have just been forced to do, like when we were way too young and when we're way too tired, right? And when we're way too maxed out, we still have to do it. So like, it just seems bare minimum to me. And the way that they brought like one person on who seemed queer to talk on it a little bit. And then they gave I think it was two different white women who were on as well, who had some interesting things to say and were, you know, given, I would say, like an almost reasonable amount of screen time, you know? but apart from that, it's just these dudes being like, yeah, I just like clearly just like feeling like they're taking the moral high ground for having gotten their check and dipped before things got really bad. And I'm just like, you think that you have the moral high ground on that? You think this is an enormous issue that you can kind of divorce yourself from by showing up and like telling Netflix, like, I'm just like super concerned. Like, their takes, I felt were just like dry and just like not dynamic. They're basically like, you know, your like freedoms are being taken from you, man. Like you're controlled by your devices. minus the like stoner, like minus the shaggy vibe, you know, because these are the folks you were talking about. These are the like preppy, clean cut, like throw beer cans at protesters people. That's who they, that's where they then went to work and who they grew up.
Oh my God.
Like sort of performatively being like, yeah, I really hope that like they do better. I watched with my girlfriend who had a very different feeling about it. Just to like add another perspective here. She was like, no, I think that they're just sort of in line with what I was saying earlier, like doing what they can. Because they were just speaking on the ways in which social media can do things that are so unethical in terms of, I don't know, like put on my tinfoil hat and be like surveillance, but like it's not quite like that, right? And they explain it. And what was nice about it was they do explain it's not survey, it's not listening to you. Do you know what I mean? Like they're not like selling like your voice talking to you. It's not like that. It's more complicated than that. And I appreciated that like demystification because I was definitely one of the people who was like, it listens. I talked about getting a dress yesterday and now there's a dress on my timeline. Where it's about how good these algorithms are at predicting because of the sheer number of data points that they have, and that they have more data points than you think they do because they're sort of selling each other information. They're selling each other your information and in a lot of ways without your consent. So you may just not realize that when I like Googled the dress that I was thinking about, you know, that information was then given to Instagram to advertise me that dress again, to be like,
creepy.
Thought about it. Yeah. And it's definitely creepy, but it's again, the mechanism.
Yeah.
my obsession.
It's like trying to see the exact code for that. Like it's possible.
Right. But yeah, so I appreciated that take on it. And what Liz had to say was like, oh, that's what they can do. Cause that's what they know. Like they don't know about ethics or whatever, but what they do know about is how this works. So like they should be on camera saying these things because that is their personal bare minimum. Take that as you will. I personally wasn't convinced. I was still mad, but I mean, she makes points, you know? Okay. I feel like I got derailed a very long ass time ago when I was trying to do ridiculous comparison between these two movies. And you already know how I feel about Happiest Season. I already talked about the twins and I need not say any more about that. I think that should tell you how I felt about it. However, the same thing that we already know, it's the same thing that you know as a writer who like knows the pressure that is on your shoulders because you're not a white writer, knows what happens when you say that one thing about your family and you put it out there. Right. And you are one of two people who look like you who got published in that by that publisher in that year. And now you said the thing, you said the thing, you know, like insert stereotype here. Like, how dare you say this thing? Right. And the way, as much as I feel Clea DuVall is not on my side, I do not believe she would in any capacity include me in her community, despite the fact that I am a queer woman. Like, she would not do that. And so this is not me standing or whatever, you know, like absolutely not. But like, it is a bummer. It is a bummer to see a woman and a man like execute a similar thing to a similar level, I would say, right? Not, which is not me talking about comparing quality of the movie, right? But like, when just looking at that relentless quality, that like, I will not give you a break. I will not give you a break from the weird, cringy microaggressions coming from this family. So part of the plot is that, so Kristen Stewart plays the girlfriend who doesn't have a family and who is coming home to her girlfriend's family. And they find out that like, she's not out. So like, that's the premise, right? And it's like also supposed to be like a feel good holiday movie, which like, that's a lot of things to put in one movie, but okay. So like, that's the premise. And so it had to have sort of mandatorily the like cutesy, like feel good, warm ending or whatever. And people are mad about that for so many reasons. They're like, she should have been with Aubrey Plaza. I personally love that she does not end up with Aubrey Plaza, because that, I really love the way that there was also allowed to be a queer friendship. You notice how that's not a thing? Like, and it's so far from reality in life. Like, every queer person has queer friends. It's really weird that they refuse to acknowledge that in the cinema. Like, it's just not that weird. I thought that that was so important. And like, that did a lot for me watching it as like someone who wanted to be seen in some capacity, given that I'm not white, right? That was the one capacity in which I was seen. I was like, ah, she has a friend. So do I. I have a friend. Right. And so that's the quality that I think the two movies share, is that they don't stop. Like, you get to a moment where you're like, this is so cringe. Like, I want to throw up, and they just keep going. And interesting, just interesting to me. If you look up reviews, you don't even have to read them, but if you look up reviews for Uncut Gems, it's all these, it's of Vanity Fair and like all like Rotten Tomatoes, everybody being like, Adam Sandler gives us a like incredible to the point of nausea like depiction of like this like man's life. Like, we get a real insight into the culture and like, and but with Happy Season, that's, it's all this other criticism, right? Which is not me saying let's not criticize Happy Season. Like, please, for the love of God, let's criticize the twins. Avenge the twins. Somebody avenge the twins for me. Like, do it right, do it thoroughly. But so it's not me saying that. It's me saying like, it's a bummer. It's a bummer to be a woman putting something out into the world and that's how it gets received. It's a bummer to watch a man put something out into the world that has a similar quality to it, you know, even if it's that similarity is a stretch maybe, but like, it's a bummer to watch that happen, and you watch it happen all the time. And I'm scared. Like, as much as I want to go to grad school and I like want to be published, I want, like, I'm scared. I don't want to be Clea DuVall. That's the other thing. I don't want to be the person whose work people are like poking holes through and being like, well, this wasn't very inclusive of the da 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 da. Like, I am trying, and I'm going to have flaws built into that effort. And it just feels like it's going to be very bad the day that I miss something and I'm not able to see through it. And like, that is a feeling that, you know, I don't want to have a lot of empathy for, like, people who hate me for existing, but like, that is something we have in common, like me and the racists and the like blue line folks. Like, we have that in common, is that like, you can't put things out into the world and not be like treated terribly by people who disagree with you. And it's obviously dramatically different when there's like different levels of power involved. Like, me having like my book deal taken away from me by a publisher, me having my literal income jeopardized because I said something online, which is what happens to Black women who say the wrong thing, right? Immediately, just like immediately, like the first thing that goes out the window is your ability to provide for yourself and your ability to like literally live your life. And that's not the same thing that happens to white, but like, Clea DuVall's fine, right? Like, she's gonna be fine. And many other white folks will also be fine. So I'm not saying it's the same. because it's definitely not, but I do kind of understand the feeling of like you wanted me to do all that in one movie. You said you need to make the perfect holiday lesbian rom-com movie. I can't do that either. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't, I don't have that skill. I don't know anyone who has that skill. So it's like, I have extraordinarily mixed feelings on all fronts. Yeah, I was, so I got a fellowship from the Hughes Foundation, which is just this lovely organization for like writers and poets of color. I intentionally, when I got on Twitter, was like, I'm going to follow, if I want to hear from authors, I want to hear from authors of color, right? If I want to hear from agents, I want to hear from agents of color. And so those are the people that I follow. Which is a shockingly small list of people, because the unbearable whiteness of literature. But yeah, so I started with that. And then I was like, now it's time to have the same attitude, but for workshop. So I was looking for a workshop or a space or of some kind where I'm like, this is for people of color and by people of color. And the sort of point person for it run is Denise Andrews, who is a wonderful and supportive and lovely Black woman. So I was like, I feel in good hands. I am going to apply. But like, we just wrapped the first round of the workshop piece, and the readings that they pick. Do you know what I mean? It's just so like, it's all this gorgeous, like relatable and prose mostly for me, right? But there's lots of wonderful poetry as well. It's not my area. So I'll read to appreciate, but in terms of like, to really like nourish and to get me thinking about my own craft and to sort of put me in a spot where I feel like I can write now, I need prose for that. So it was amazing. The things that we got to read and the ways that we all sat around and really got into that. You know, and talked about like our fears as people of color going out there and like putting words out there and putting our names on those words. And just the way that those words will be treated because they come from us, right? And like how to manage that and what to do about it, how if we can prepare, how do we do it? You know, like we spent so much time getting into that. And I loved that. I was like, finally, the things I never can talk about in workshop because white people either don't want to discuss it because it makes them uncomfortable, or they like do want to discuss it but don't know how to do it without being offensive. That's not a price I want to pay always going into a workshop. Like, I will be offended. I will be hurt, and I need to just deal with that because I'm also going to learn things, and that's the price I pay to learn. Like, I didn't want to pay that price to learn. Like, nah, fuck out of here. No. So that's what got me applying, and is what's been motivating so far to write. I am hoping the chapbook will be an exploration of home some kind. I'm a very sort of like kaleidoscopic view of home because I don't want to say like fractured. I don't come from a broken home or whatever fucked up stereotypes because I'm Black and me and my dad fight. Like, I don't, it's not like that. But it is complicated. Home has been a very complicated place for like a lot of reasons, some of which are literally physical, right? I'm Dominican. So and my mom lives in DR. So like home in a lot of ways is when I'm with her in DR, right? But also, you know, my dad, I was like primarily raised in Texas. So, and like, that's where my dad still lives. And so it's like Texas is also in a lot of ways home, right? And then I feel like I didn't really come into my own until I was here in Brooklyn. And so in like a way that I know is complicated because there's the like gentrification conversation that is like extremely important and like should not be put to the side. But like in some ways, New York is my real home as well. So I'm hoping that I can sort of render those, all of those different feelings of home. That's what I'm hoping. Before there was the restriction of COVID, there was the restriction of finances. You know, when I transitioned out of the classroom, like I took a financial L there. So I was in a tight spot for a while there. If all goes well, I'll be seeing her in April. I sometimes feel like this level of independent feeling is like a character flaw. I wonder sometimes if I'm just like extraordinarily flighty and like that's what it is. I also wonder sometimes if I'm just a Sagittarius, you know? Like, it's really.
What are the Sagittarius stereotypes? Like, I don't know anything about astrology. I remember we were at the airport coming back from Tin House and I was like trying to text my mom when I was born because I didn't know what my rising and my stuff was. And I'm like, yeah, Chinese people don't keep birth certificates.
Take what serves you, right? Take what serves you. But, the sad stereotypes are that we're like the person you want to come, you want to invite to the party and you really, really, really want them to be there. So you tell them that it starts an hour before it does because they will be late. And then you acknowledge that chaos will ensue as soon as they do show up. And then you acknowledge that you will be mad at them, but only briefly because we're also pretty charming. So
that's so it's a great one.
Yeah, it's a fire sign. It's a lot of chaos energy. It's a lot of like adventurous energy too. Like Sagittarius are known for wanting to travel a lot. But yeah, in terms of my family, it's not my fault. I was raised to be flighty. We bounced around a lot. So I was born in Puerto Rico. My sister was born in Miami. My parents were both born in Dominican Republic. So we spent a lot of time bouncing back and forth between all those places, plus Miami, which is a like stronghold of my family. There's like a contingent there, that has since like dispersed a little bit. But when we were growing up, it was a very strong Miami contingent. And then we were all the way out in Fort Worth due to my dad's work. So, I got very used to like not sitting still. And in fact, I didn't learn how to sit still until the year of our Lord 2020. So,
all right, that's the episode. Thank you so much for tuning in this past year. I know this podcast just started in August, and this is our last episode of 2020. It's been an insane year, and I'm really looking forward to talking with you guys again next year. So see you in 2021 with our new episodes. Bye.